So I hear congratulations are in order. You got your second vaccine shot.
I
Your face was like, what did I
was
do?
like, what did I do? I didn't realize that I had congratulations. Yeah, I got my second shot. I'm fully vaccinated. Well, I guess it's in 2 weeks I'll be fully vaccinated.
Right. However long it like needs to build a house in your cells or whatever
Yeah.
a vaccine does.
The brick house.
I just imagine it like Osmosis Jones,
Yeah.
like
Back in biology when they would play those like videos where it would show, yeah, same thing, yeah.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. I mean, the first shot, I didn't really have that much of a reaction. I think I had a headache, but I also realized I have TMJ. I was just diagnosed with TMJ.
Oh, welcome to the wonderful world. It's
Yeah.
awful.
So, but I got a night guard. My dentist like made me a night guard and I love it. I mean, she said I wasn't gonna like it for the first couple of days or weeks. She was like, "You'll get used to it, but you'll probably hate it, but then you won't be able to sleep without it." And honestly, just not waking up with a headache or feeling like the tightness in your jaw is just magical to me, so I love my night guard. But I just the headache was a little weird the first shot, and then but I just powered through it. This one I thought the same. The first day I was like, oh, I'm just really sleepy and I'm just gonna take a nap. Like, couldn't even keep my eyes open. And then in the middle of the night I spiked a fever,
Oh, gosh.
and like I had chills and like night sweats. And then I was like, okay, obviously this is like from the shot. And I was like hot, so I kept taking the covers off, but then like the cool air would sting my skin because I was so
Oh,
achy. So I just like suffered through it and just like stayed under the covers. But I just took two Advil and then I slept perfectly the rest of the night. Like once
that's
the
good.
fever broke from taking Advil, I was fine. And then the next day I was still a little sleepy and just achy, but then I just took Advil and I just decided that, there was nothing I needed to get up and do. So I was like, why am I going to force myself to like get up and clean or get work done? Like, I just lay down, just
Yeah.
let's just relax. Like, there's no reason for you to go crazy. So.
That's what I tell myself every day, whether or not I have a shot. Just relax, just lay down.
You don't have anything to get up for. I think
Nothing
you said that
to
last week. You were like, I don't have anything to get up for, so.
I mean,
Yeah.
listen.
Yeah, it's all good. But yeah, I'm fully vaccinated or will be shortly, and it feels
Yay.
great. I will continue to wear my mask when I leave my home. However, I do feel like I'm smirking a little bit underneath it, like, haha,
That's so funny.
like fuck you, COVID.
Gotcha.
You ain't getting me. But it's so crazy to think a year, literally a year, what is it, April? Yeah, we were like full
Over a
on in
year.
lockdown a
Yeah.
year ago, and now I'm vaccinated, so it
You know
feels
what's
really good.
crazy too? I think we talked about this, but I'm going to say it again, is that we started this podcast February 2020. So we only recorded what, three episodes in person and everything else we've done on Zoom. And remember when you were like, should we even continue the podcast?
I
Like,
know. We
it's just
almost gave
like
up.
we almost like gave, well, no, I wouldn't say gave up, but we almost like went on hiatus because we were like, it's extra negativity in the world, is it? Whatever. But then we realized people are still being murdered,
Oh, yeah.
even whether or not there's a lockdown, probably even more so.
Yeah. I think, and I think we were just like also not sure how we were going to do it remotely. Like, we never thought that it was going to be possible, but
And still to this day, every single time we record, there's something that
there's
goes
something wrong.
wrong.
Something happens. We've been doing it for over a year and we still can't figure
I
out how to
still
get it
can't.
together. But
Nope.
I think that's going to be our thing. That's going to be our
It's just part of our charm.
it's just a part it's a part of the everyday recording life of a
Oh, God.
podcaster.
But all that to say, thank you, audience, for
Oh
sticking with
yeah.
us.
For a whole year.
We,
Oh, we didn't
yeah.
even do like a did we do a year anniversary? Did Kelsey
I don't know.
I don't think she did. I don't think we even asked her to do it.
Not on her. That's on us.
Oh, no, yeah. I just didn't know if she maybe just did it and I forgot.
We could do a retroactive one. That's fine.
Yeah.
Celebratory post or something.
That's true. That's very true.
But as we go into our second year.
Yeah.
We want to grow our audience. We want more to hear from you guys about what you think, any cases you're interested in. Mm-hmm. So make sure to subscribe if you haven't already subscribed. Leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you review your podcasts. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at onthearbehalf_pod to keep up with all of our updates, except apparently anniversary posts, because we cannot do that. Because
we don't do that in this neck of the woods. but any cases you guys have heard of or stuff, mm-hmm. There's so many, that are underreported and underrepresented that we don't even know about. Like, we do a lot mm-hmm. of researching, but it doesn't mean that we know of all of them. So if you know of a case that you want us to cover and go do like a deep dive, just like DM us on Instagram. That would be a great way to get your suggestion.
Yeah. We're also on Twitter.
Yes. Twitter, Instagram, and we do have a Facebook page too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
All right. Yeah, so this week I'm going to tell Devin a story, or not a story, it's not a story, it's a case. And I did, and I think I say this every week, every time I'm about to tell a story, I say this. I go into like the darkest holes of research and I change my mind, and then I usually like start. I mean, you're better at it, Devin, to like, I think you had like a couple of cases that you knew you wanted to do across the season. So, but for me, I was just like, I'm going to let the inspiration strike me, and I'm going to let, whatever case I see pop up, and I'm going to cover it. And I had one in mind. And then literally Friday, I was like, nope, I'm not doing this one anymore. I'm going to do this one. And then I was like, you know what? No. And then last night I was like, nope, I'm not going to do this one. I'm going to do this one. And then I literally had twice. Then guess what I did? I went back to the first one that I was going to do. So this is the first case that I was going to do.
Oh my goodness.
It's like a lot of our stories, there's not much information about it. And mm-hmm. It's really hard for me to trust. I don't want to say trust, but like, I trust Wikipedia more than I trust like Reddit threads, to be honest.
Oh, well, at least Wikipedia, you have to have sources and you can like go to the sources.
And then find, So, but this specific case doesn't have a Wikipedia page. So a lot of what I researched or found out about it is stuff from like Reddit or, and like local papers that have posted about mm-hmm. this. It's not like a paper, but like, local websites that have reported mm-hmm. about this case. So this week I'm going to tell the case on behalf of Hannah Zahner Brim. January 23rd, 2016, Susan Zahner.
Sorry, that's my sister's birthday.
Oh. Oh my God.
Continue.
Okay. I thought you were, I was like, do you know Susan Zahner? That's what I thought you were going to say. No, it's okay. So it's January 23rd, 2016. And Susan Zahner from Gainesville, Florida, she gets a phone call from an extended stay motel where her daughter, Hannah, was staying. So they call her, they ask her if they've heard from Hannah, or if her mother has heard from Hannah, and if she knows if she's going to return and check out of the hotel, because she was supposed to check out that day. And her mother is immediately like, no, I haven't talked to her, but let me try to get a hold of her and figure out, you know, what's going on. Mm-hmm. And a large part of where I'm getting this information, other than like Reddit threads and, you know, kind of the local Gainesville, websites, was from a episode of On the Case, with Paula Zane. I don't know if you've heard of her before.
No.
It's like, you know, like she covers a case every week, and it's kind of like investigative discovery kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she, when I found out that she did an episode on Hannah, I started to go through her, she has like 22 seasons of this show.
Oh, man.
And as well as she does, and I give her credit for, you know, telling these stories, but there was probably one person of color every season out of, like, 30 episodes. So,
mm-hmm.
that's a problem, Paula, mm-hmm. but, you know, hey. So I got a lot of this information from that episode.
And is Hannah a person of color?
Yes, Hannah is a person of color. Yes, she's okay. Black. Well, she's okay. She might be mixed, because again, I can't find out a lot about her.
Mm-hmm.
But she is Black.
Okay.
And so in this episode, Paula asks the parents, like, when did you know something was wrong? And Susan and Hannah's father, Art, that's his name, Art Zahner, they say immediately, as soon as they got that phone call and they tried calling her afterwards and got her voicemail, they knew immediately something was wrong. Mm. So they call her friends, they call her husband, because Hannah was married at the time, and they had not heard from her for days. And so they then decide to go over to the extended stay motel, and they first notice that her car wasn't there. So they kind of like have like a sigh of relief, like, okay, maybe she just went somewhere for, you know, to spend time with somebody or get away from it all. Like, and she's coming back. Like, maybe that's the case. But
mm-hmm.
then they get into the hotel room, and everything looks normal. There's no struggle. Her toothbrush was there. Her hairbrush was there. Her cell phone charger was there. So, like, everything that you would need to, like, go away for a couple days was mm-hmm. still in the hotel room.
Was still
room.
There. Mm-hmm.
So, everything in the hotel room indicated that she was planning on coming back shortly mm-hmm. after leaving. The only things that were missing were her purse, her jacket, and her cell phone. So they call the police, and there's a 911 call that Art makes to the Gainesville Police Department and says, my daughter is missing, my wife is very concerned, and, you know, can somebody come out and help us? So they put out, you know, over the radio that Susan Zahner called in, and that their daughter is missing. So mm-hmm. Officer Nicholas Byrd, he hears this call go over the radio, and he rushes over immediately because he knows the Zahner family. He's known them since he was like 15 years old.
Mm.
And he says that Hannah has a beautiful son, a toddler, and she was also pregnant at the time, so she wouldn't have left without telling anybody where she was going.
She was pregnant?
She was 17 weeks pregnant at the time, and she had a toddler. So he was like, there's no way that she would have left without telling her mother where she was going.
Do we know why she was in the extended stay hotel?
Yes, I'll get to that. So Hannah was, she was living in Gainesville with her husband. So her and mm-hmm. her husband, she was married. I couldn't find his name. Not even in this show do they name the husband or the son. They just say that he's a toddler, that the little boy was a toddler.
I heard it as the husband was a toddler.
Oh, no. He probably was.
Oh, no.
Like most men act at some point in their lives. But... so she lived there with her husband, and Hannah was, and she just lived miles away from her adoptive parents. So the first thing that kind of struck me when I started watching this was that both of her parents were white.
Okay, I was just going to say.
So I was like, yeah, and I was like very confused, but they don't even acknowledge it in the show, like that obviously she's of color and her parents aren't. And then there's also a family photo, and she has other siblings that are also white. So I was like, okay. Obviously, there's something, you know, like she was adopted.
But that's kind of nice because they don't qualify, like...
Yeah, like, that's
sometimes I feel like when they're just like, that's my daughter and that's my adopted daughter. Yeah. It's like, why do you have to differentiate? They're both your daughter.
They're both your children. And throughout the a lot of the Gainesville articles that I read, they do refer to her as... their adoptive child and adoptive parents. So I kind of just like, okay, that's her daughter. Like, what's the big deal?
I feel like, I don't know a lot about like the world of adoption or anything, but I do feel like maybe there are some cases when you do want to qualify it as adopted daughter when maybe the biological parents are still in the picture or something like that. So
that's true.
It's a way to acknowledge the background. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just... trying to broaden my mind. I mean,
there was no indication in this show or any of my research that her biological parents were involved at all.
Okay.
And she was adopted at 2 months old. So okay. I'm going to assume that they weren't.
Yeah.
And they had another adopted child as well. So they didn't have their own biological children. All of their children were adopted. Mm. And like I said, the background of Hannah and how she met her husband and how she got to this point is really unclear. The only thing that, you know, is mentioned is that her and her husband were separated and that they were recently separated and going through a tough time.
Okay.
So, but she was 5 months pregnant and the relationship just started to sour. So that's why she was staying in the extended stay.
That's so hard. Yes. Oh my gosh.
So, and her mom mentions, like, you know, she knew about what was going on with Hannah, and it's also not clear whether they were like, and I found out later that it was more of like they were just separated, they weren't legally separated, and things were inching more towards a divorce than they weren't. But it's really not clear because it's really her word against her husband's word. So that's why she was staying at the extended stay. But she was supposed to check out that day. And it's not clear if she was going back home or if she was going to her parents or what the case was. But she did have a really great relationship with her parents. And like I said, her mother knew everything that was going on with her and her husband, and they supported her going to the extended stay hotel to get away from the situation and clear her head and figure out what her next steps were going to be. And her son was staying with her husband. So that's why she was there. Her father, Art, said, quote, "I had a good relationship with her. She would always keep in contact with me. No matter where she was, she would call and say, 'I'm here.' And if she needed me, she knew she could call me and I would go get her anywhere she was," end quote. So that's why it was very odd that they hadn't spoke to her in a couple of days. And now it's not only them haven't heard from her, but like her friends haven't heard from her. Mm-hmm. And she's not answering her cell phone. She's not at this hotel where she said she was going to be. It's just not in her character to do that. So her parents report her missing on January 23rd, 2016. And the police come to the extended stay. And they, you know, assess the room the same as her parents did. They said nothing's out of place. Everything looks like she's going to come back any minute. Like she could mm-hmm. walk through the door any minute. Officer Byrd, who knows the family, is kind of heading the whole search, I guess you can say, because there's not an actual investigation happening right now because it's very new. And I know even in 2016, actually, it's been years since the whole 48 hours thing. Like, you can't report somebody missing before 48 hours. Like, that's not a thing anymore. So they're starting to look for her, even though there's not a formal investigation. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I just want to mention here that there is no... Like, we usually cover cases where it's like, the police didn't care and they didn't treat this case the way that they should have. This is not one of those cases. Like, everybody in this town was looking for Hannah. And the police were very, like, active and did everything that they could to try to find her, which is kind of a breath of fresh air. So when I started when I started to research this case, I was like looking for that moment that was like, oh, I want to be pissed off about. Like, obviously I'm gonna be pissed by the end of it, but it was just refreshing to know that, like, oh, they're like, they don't always treat everybody like shit, you know. So Officer Byrd, he's looking around the hotel room, and he notices a small makeup bag that Hannah had, and on the inside, like on the satin part of the makeup bag, is a series of numbers and letters that are written down on like a Sharpie. So he's like, that's kind of weird. So he looks at it and he says, it's clearly a VIN number, like a vehicle identification number. So he runs this VIN number and he's like, okay, I don't know why she would write this down, but I'm going to run the VIN number. And he runs the number and the vehicle is registered to a Nelson Armis.
Okay.
And they contact him and they realize that Nelson is somebody who is in Hannah's life. He's a friend of hers. So they contact him and they ask him, you know, where, if he's seen her. And he says he has not seen her in about 3 or 4 days. And he has no idea why she would write down that VIN number, because that VIN number actually belongs to his wife. It's his wife's car. So he's like, I have no idea why she would have that information. But hey, if I hear from her or if she contacts me, like, I'll let you guys know. Like, she's a good friend of mine and I want to help you guys. So they, you know, they kind of are like, okay, you know, if you hear of her or if you, you know, hear from her, please let us know. And he says yes. So then they go, you know, a little bit further and they try to find... get access to her phone records, and they because her parent, that's another thing, like, anybody listening to this forever and ever and ever, make sure that your parents or anybody close to you, your husband, your significant other, your best friends, that they know the passwords to your cell phone information, your to access your cell phone records, because it, if you don't, it takes the police like weeks to get a court order to be able to access your phone records. But if your parents or your friends are able
what
to get...
What password would that be?
So, like, if you... Like, I have like Verizon. I have Verizon.
Oh, so it's like your account password.
Yeah, so I can... I have my account password in my phone. And Nikita, my best friend, she has that password. So if I ever go missing... then she is able to log on to Verizon.com and access my Verizon account. And that gives the police access to my phone records. So then they can see where I've been for however long. So this kind of was expedited in this case. Her parents were aware of her cell phone data and all that stuff. So they, the police were able to access her cell phone records, and they... and her social media accounts, and everything stopped on the 19th. Everything. She didn't receive any phone calls after that point. She did not post anything.
So that's 4 days before the hotel calls.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Detective Byrd is
he the family friend?
He's the detective. The detective knew them from when they were 15. Since he was younger. So he reaches out to the family and he says, do you want me to lie to you or tell you the truth?
Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God.
And Susan says, you better just tell me the truth. And he says, quote, I don't think this is going to end well. So, in this episode of On the Case, she asks them, Paula asks them if they, at this time, if they held out any hope. And Art, her father, or Hannah's father, says, you have to. Even though Detective Byrd came to us and said that this is probably not going to end well, he was just like, as a parent, you just have to hold out hope. And he's like, even after that, it kind of, the timeline of, you know, she's been missing for 4 days. No one has seen her or spoken to her in 4 days. Even though that timeline indicated foul play, he was like, there was, I did not want to believe it until I knew for sure.
Right.
So, now there's an official investigation because it's been 4 days and they can tell that her cell phone records, indicate that she has not, communicated with anybody in 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
So where do they go first? The husband.
Yep. That's why I'm surprised that you couldn't find anybody's name.
I know.
Because that's always the, or his particular name.
Yeah, yeah. So they go to the husband, and he admits that they were going through a rough patch, and that, you know, their issues led to their separation, and he knew that she was staying in Gainesville at a hotel to kind of get away and hope to deal with their issues. He said that he had every intention of doing everything that he could to get her back and to continue their marriage. That it was not him that wanted to end their marriage, that it was her, that she was having second thoughts. And now with the pregnancy, she was just concerned that their marriage wasn't going to last. And, that he also felt like there's no way that she would just leave without saying anything to anybody, especially because he said that their issues in their marriage would never keep that, keep her away from their son, because she would come and see her son almost every day. You know, there was no way she would go 4 days without seeing him, and their issues in their marriage would never prevent her from doing that. And he would never prevent her from doing that. So they, you know, ask him all the necessary questions like, where were you on that night? and are on the 19th. And he has an alibi. He says that he was home with their son because there was nobody else to watch their son, and that he didn't have a car to leave. So, and I couldn't also find out like how far away he lived from the hotel compared to the parents. The only indication of like actual mileage in this sense is I read in an article that she lived not too far from her parent, her adoptive parents. So I'm assuming it's within, you know, a certain amount of miles, but the mother in this, On the Case episode, Paula mentions that it took her parents 30 minutes to get to the extended stay hotel the day that they reported her missing. So I'm going to assume that everything's about 30 minutes-ish from each other.
Does he have anybody other than a 4-year-old to corroborate his alibi?
No.
Mm.
He does not. So the only other evidence that kind of puts him on the back burner is that his Hannah's parents say, absolutely not. He would never do something like this. He would never even lay a hand on her. Like, there would never be a situation where they thought that he was responsible for this. So they kind of just keep their eye on him and see, like, okay, is he acting weird? But really, they are just like, this, he seems like a worried, distraught father who can't find the mother of his children. Like, that's, mm-hmm. you know. So now they're looking at her cell phone records to see who the last person she spoke to, or who the last person that saw her that day. So they find out that she had a phone call and text messages to a friend of hers. Her name is Abriana. And mm-hmm. Abriana says that she did see her on the 19th, that they were hanging out. And she saw her around noon when Hannah dropped her off at work. And that's the last time she saw her. But they did text after that point, because Hannah did text her around 1 o'clock. And she said that she wasn't really, like, paying attention to what she was saying at, like, you know, as she was texting, because she was at work and she got busy. So she told her, you know, don't worry, I'll call you when I get out of work. And we can talk then. But she did say that Hannah was very upset and was really confused because she wasn't sure about what she wanted to do about her husband. And she just was unsure about the split and, like, how she want, what her next steps were. Mm-hmm. And then Abriana says that she did try to reach out to her later when she got off of work, but didn't get any response from Hannah at all. And then she didn't hear from her again after that point. Mm-hmm. So then they move on to the next person that they has had contact with her on the 19th. And that person was Rebecca. And also, they don't say anybody's last names. All these people are over 18. I don't know why.
I wonder if it's just, like, because they're trying to protect people from the public making their own assumptions and then backlash, maybe? Because I feel like those programs often sort of, like, have an impact on people's personal lives, whether or not they're actually guilty or involved or anything in a negative way. So maybe that's what that's about. Yeah. I don't know.
I feel like it's the equivalent of, like, those old Discovery, like, investigative shows where they would interview people, but it would just be, like, their silhouette.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, at least, but these people actually interviewed, like, you can see them. They just don't mention their last names for some reason. Mm-hmm. So Rebecca, she's actually the last person that speaks to Hannah that day. And she says that they had a call between 2 and 3 p.m. And in her interview, she says that they had plans to meet up that day. And this interaction with the police and Rebecca basically turns this whole investigation, like, completely.
Oh my gosh.
So Detective James Parker, he speaks to Rebecca over the phone first, I think, because that's how it's kind of indicated on the show, and then they go to her home to interview her. And she tells them that they knew each other from high school, and she hasn't seen her in years, but they decided to reconnect and they were supposed to hang out that day. But the story that she gives Detective Parker is, like, kind of insane in like the weirdest way. So she says that they had plans to run errands and, like, have lunch and kind of just do the normal hanging out kind of thing. And she was waiting for Hannah to arrive. And she looked outside her window and noticed something weird, like, and they show, like, an aerial view of everybody, like, the property.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Florida, so it's, like, swamp country. So, like, everything's kind of, like, remote, and there's a lot of trees and, like, you know, these weird roads. So her home looks like it's kind of like a dirt road. So she sees a car sitting in, like, at the end of her driveway with all of the doors open and she can't see anybody around it. So she's like, okay, that must be Hannah. So she goes outside and it's a silver car. It's parked on the road and she approaches the car and a white man jumps up from the opposite side of the car and yells at her and tells her to stop. And she stops and she's like, what's going on? And he goes, stop, we're having sex. So now she's like, oh shit. Like, oh, she's kind of embarrassed. So she's like, oh, okay, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And then she like walks back into her house. Like, who wouldn't like just be like, oh my God. You know, like how shocking would that be? Yeah. So then she says that she didn't see anybody else but this man. And so she, and he didn't threaten her in any way. She said just like the sheer awkwardness of approaching a car with all the doors open and then someone being like, leave us alone, we're having sex, made her just look away like quickly. And she didn't really notice anything else other than the man. So then she just goes back into her house.
Oh my God.
So then, when she gets back into her house, maybe a few minutes, 10 minutes or whatever later, she gets a text from Hannah saying that she is sorry and she can't make it. So now she's like, okay. So, she just kind of went about her day. She just was like, okay, you know, sorry we couldn't connect and, you know, went on with her life. And she notices a couple minutes later, she looks outside the window and the car is gone and the man is gone. So she's like, okay. So, when the police are interviewing her, they're like, that's odd. Like, do you know what he looked like? Can you describe what he looked like? You know, and she tells them, the description of the man and the description of the car. And the police are like, okay, well, that's the exact description of the car that Hannah drives. And now Rebecca's like, well, I haven't seen her in years. We went to high school together. I have no idea what kind of car she drove. So they're like, okay, well, let's get you into the station. We want to take a formal interview with you, a recorded interview. And they have that interview on the show. Now I'm like up in my seat, like what is going on? What is happening? Like what's going on? So they bring her in, they do a formal interview with her, and she says that she thought the car was abandoned because all the doors were open. And it's not like the road that the car was on was like her private driveway. It was like the main dirt road and it just connected to her driveway. So that's why she approached it thinking it may be Hannah, not realizing where her house was. So that's why she approached it. But then once she realized that all the doors are open, she was like, oh, somebody must have like just dumped the car and there was nobody around the car. So she couldn't tell like that there was anybody in it. And she said, but then when he popped up from the ground, it startled her. And he said that they were having sex. So then she just turned around and kind of like walked away quickly. So then they're asking her like, well, did you see anybody else in the car? And she said, no, it was, I didn't see anybody in the car. I just saw him jump up from the ground. And they were like, okay, well, are you sure he didn't jump up from the back seat of the car? Or like, are you sure he jumped up from the ground? And she's like, no, he was on the ground on the other side of the car. He didn't get out of the car at all. So she was like, so they were like, okay, that's odd, but like, just describe him. They have somebody do a sketch of him. He's the, you know, medium build, you know, certain amount of height, dark beard, dark hair, you know, dark eyes. So they do this sketch and she, you know, is doing the interview and she's like, I'm really sorry that I can't help you guys out anymore. Like, that's the only interaction that I had after Hannah was supposed to come to my house. And then I got a text from her and that she wasn't coming. So I didn't think that those two things were related. So then,
like, why would you know?
Yeah, right. Like, why would you think that those two, especially she hasn't seen Hannah in so long. Right. So So now at this point, Rebecca, because they're explaining to her that that's the same car that Hannah drives. It was a Toyota Camry. It was silver. So now Hannah is like, or not Hannah, I'm sorry. Rebecca is like, oh shit. Like, I think that was maybe the guy that could be responsible for her, for Hannah disappearing. And the police are like convinced as well that she came face to face with this guy. Mm-hmm. So as they're finishing up, Rebecca's interview, another detective gets a phone call from Nelson Armas. Do you remember that guy? Okay, so Nelson Armas, he's the man whose wife's VIN number was written on the inside of Hannah's makeup bag. So he says that he has, you know, that he thinks he has more information for them. So they say, okay, come down to the station and to give your account of what happened. And he's basically like, I have been following the case and I realized that my interactions with Hannah over the last couple of days could really help you guys out. So he tells them that he was with Hannah on the 19th. And he agrees to show the police some of the places that he and Hannah went that day. So, and he's like, I think I can be helpful and like fill in some holes for you guys. So he says, quote, I feel like this is a priority. Someone is missing, you know. So the sooner I can get this done, I'd love to help you out.
Why wouldn't end he quote. Say anything like that in the beginning / king of the police over here? Like, okay, sir.
Yeah. So I have my thoughts, but yeah. Let's keep going. So he admits that he and Hannah were having an affair. He is married, obviously.
Why am I not surprised?
Exactly. Mm. He and Hannah were having an affair, mm-hmm. and he said, quote, I was using her as a Band-Aid. I was hurting. My wife wanted nothing to do with me, so I just wanted somebody to be there, end quote.
Right, I don't really care about that, but...
Mm-hmm. But, you know, he needs to say something to make him not look like just this skeezy guy that's just cheating on his wife.
Right.
So then he says that Hannah wanted things to get more serious, but that wasn't something that he was looking for. He said, and this is like actual recorded, like audio. So like it's his actual voice in this show that like him saying this stuff. Dang. So I'm like, I listened to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So he says that he never intended to have a relationship with her. He was just using her as a crutch. So at 1:30 p.m., they go back to her hotel. I'm assuming he has sex with her. Mm-hmm. He doesn't say that, but why else would you go back to her hotel room? So I'm assuming they have sex. Around 1:30 p.m., he says that they have an argument. And it's about the fact that she wants things to get more serious with him, and she wants to end her marriage, and she knows that his marriage isn't working out. Like, let's just be together and try to figure this out. And he doesn't want anything to do with it. So they have this argument and he storms out and tries to walk home. So,
okay.
Then she rushes out after him and drives alongside of him walking on the street and is pleading with him to get back in the car and be with her or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he does. He gets in the car and she is starting to drive him home. And he says that Hannah refuses to believe that this relationship is over, and this leads to her slapping him across the face. Mm-hmm. So then the detective asks him, well, what did you do when she slapped you across the face? Mm-hmm. And he says, I kept my hands on my lap and just really tried to stay calm and asked her to pull over and let me out of the car. And she does. She pulls over, she lets him out of the car, and he says that she drove away, like, sped away, that she was pissed and just sped away. Mm-hmm. And that he walked back to Gainesville on foot. Mm-hmm. Then at the end of this interview, he says, quote, "I really hope y'all find her. She even has me worried." End quote.
So narcissistic.
It's
the phrasing.
Yeah. Oh, very weird. And so then the police at this point are like, wow, thank you. This is really helpful. And they really believe him. They really, truly believe him. Mm-hmm. And honestly, in the show, at this point in the show, I believe him too, because the mm-hmm. way that he's talking about this situation. And the only question I had was, when they reached out to you in the beginning about her having your wife's VIN number in her mm-hmm. room, why didn't you say this then? Like, why didn't you come up? And I get why.
Like, obvious, yeah, is like protecting from the affair and mm-hmm. blah, 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 but like.
Yeah. And that's his excuse, really, is like, listen, right. I didn't want this to go any further. People have affairs is his whole thing. Like, people do mm-hmm. this. It was a fucked up mistake. I tried to end it and it didn't end well, but she mm-hmm. left me on the side of the road and I walked home because I had no choice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to make it work with my wife. Like, that's literally where he's going with this. And the police believe him. He has given them a lot of information that they didn't have before. And mm-hmm. it adds to the timeline as to that if that happened at 1:30, she would have still had time to then go meet Rebecca, because she didn't talk to Rebecca until between 2 and 3.
Okay.
So he says that he then, when she dropped him off and sped away, he hitchhiked back to Gainesville and then walked the remaining 13 miles that would have taken him to get home.
Okay.
So,
is it 2016? Don't they have, like, Uber?
Yeah. Well, maybe not in Gainesville. I don't know.
Maybe not in Gainesville.
Okay, so now that he tells them that he walked the 13 miles, the police are like, oh, so you didn't get a ride all the way to Gainesville. Mm-hmm. Like, or home. You didn't get a ride the whole way there.
Right.
And he says, no, they could only take me 13 miles out, and then I had to walk the rest of the way. So now they're like, oh, okay. So if you walked, it would have taken you 4 hours to walk 13 miles, about 13 or mm-hmm. 4 hours. But your phone records, because now he doesn't know that they pulled his phone records. Ooh, 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 your phone ooh. Records show that you got home in 2 hours. How? So they're like, they kind of just leave it open like that. They're like,
did you literally run?
Yeah.
Are you a marathon runner?
Yeah.
Did you run a half marathon right then?
And now they're kind of comparing, like, her phone records and his phone records, because now he's given them the information that they were together up mm-hmm. until the point where she disappears. Mm-hmm. So they're comparing the phone records, and his phone records show that he was with her minutes before her phone went dead. Ooh. So then they're telling him this, and he just keeps saying, I understand what you're saying. I understand you. Like, I totally understand you. I understand what you're saying, but I got out of the car. And then he says, quote, I never touched her.
Okay, nobody was talking about touching her.
Yeah, like, he's offering up too much information. Mm-hmm, that's obviously, mm-hmm. like, these are homicide detectives. Like, obviously, they're going to catch on to these little things.
Yeah.
So now they realize that this, and they don't say this, but in the interview that they're having with, the officers are having with Paula, he says, this is where they realize that this is not a situation or a case in which it's going to be, we are searching for a missing person. this is soon going to be a homicide investigation. Mm. So now, at the same time, Rebecca is at the same station in the next interview room, and she finishes up her interview with them, and they are walking her out of the station, and she walks past Nelson Armas and says, "That's the guy."
Stop.
She's like, "That's the guy that popped up on the other side of the car that I was telling you guys about." And the police are like, and now those detectives that were with her interviewing her had no idea that Nelson was in the other room with the other detectives at the same time.
Oh my God, this is like a play.
Right? So she's like, yeah, that's he looks just like that guy. Now in the show, this is the first time that they show you a picture of what Nelson looks like, because the whole time that you see him, it's just the audio, and it's a video of the interrogation room, and you know how they're always up top, so you can't really see people's faces. So now they show a picture of Nelson and the sketch that she did, and they're literally identical.
Oh my gosh.
It's identical. So now Paula's interviewing the investigator, and she's like, "Did you guys do this on purpose?" And the cop is like, "No." He was like, "This."
You think we're that smart?
Yeah. He's like, "Honestly, this was just by chance." He was like, "If Nelson never reached out and said, hey, I have more information for you guys, and came down to the station, they would have never known that those two cross paths at one point." So now the police know for sure, like, this is the guy. So the detective tells his sergeant, he says, quote, "I think we have our guy here." So Rebecca says that she saw him. I think they do a lineup as well. It's kind of indicated in the show that they do a lineup, and she picks him out definitively, like, that's the guy. But because they don't have any physical evidence of, like, they don't have a body, they don't have a weapon, all they have is that he was outside of her home, possibly in a car that looked like Hannah's, having sex with somebody. The evidence that they have, they don't have enough to hold him, so they let him go. And they're like, okay, now we just got to find more evidence. Now they interview, they get in contact with Armas's wife, Stacy, and they ask her about the events that happened on the 19th. And she tells them that, yeah, she remembers that he came home he was a little nervous. But she was at Walmart that day or that night, and he asked her, then she told him, just come meet me at Walmart, you know, we'll go shopping or whatever. So then he meets her at Walmart. So now they're like, okay, now we know we can find some surveillance video of him at Walmart to see if there's anything within those surveillance videos that we can find out. So they pull the Walmart surveillance videos, and they can clearly see him walking into the Walmart and going to the store to meet his wife. But then they're like, okay, how did he get there?
13 miles. Yeah.
Like,
oh fuck. How did he get there?
How did he get to the Walmart? So now they go to the exterior Walmart surveillance video.
Oh my God.
So they watch on the surveillance video, and he pulls up in Hannah's car.
Oh my God.
He parks it and then drives home with the wife.
So they have the car.
Well, hold on, wait, yeah.
Okay. Oh my God.
So he drives home with the wife. She never questions how he got to the Walmart. She just assumes that he meets her at the Walmart, and then they go home together. So now the police are like, for sure, we got him. This is it. Like, he did it, but we just have to figure out how. So the police now believe that he, you know, something, whatever happened to Hannah happened after this argument. He used her car to get rid of her or the body, and used the car to then drive to the Walmart and left the car there. So now they're just trying to get as many witnesses as possible to testify that he drove this car and somehow got rid of the car. So, and the possible murder weapon, and, you know, so there's so many things that he would have needed to get rid of in order to, you know, and they don't say this, but, like, they just say, like, there's so many things that he would, steps he would have needed to take in order to feel comfortable enough to go to the police and be like, hey, now I have information that'll help
you. Yeah, for real.
You know, how did he feel that he covered his tracks well enough?
Yeah.
So now they have to kind of work backwards. So they believe that he, so, and they don't say where they got this information. And this part, I don't believe, came from the episode. This was from an article that I read. And our sources are always linked. So if anybody wants to go back and read the full articles, they're there. But there was a formal complaint that said that they witnessed Armas getting rid of a knife. And a knife that they believe is the murder weapon, as well as trying to get rid of Hannah's car. That he drove this car to his mother's house, where he cleaned it and burned the floor mats and anything that was in the car.
Oh my God.
But at the same time, this is happening when Hannah's parents report her missing. So Armas finds out that that she's been reported missing. So now he's got this investigation that's obviously starting, looming against him. So he's, like, trying to work faster. So he decides to just completely get the car destroyed. So the video surveillance shows him showing up and in the silver sedan, that's obviously Hannah's car, leaving it there in the parking lot on the night of January 19th. But then they watch these surveillance videos for days on this car to see, because he obviously came back and got it. So now they show he comes back to the Walmart parking lot 4 days later, 4 days, which is the same day, the 23rd, that her parents report her missing. So he comes up to the car. A friend of his drives up in an El Camino, a very distinct car. And drops him off, and Armas gets back into the Toyota Camry and drives off. So now they're like, okay, how many El Caminos of that year with that license plate could be in the Gainesville area? So they go, they find his friend that owns the El Camino, and they interview him. They find out that it's registered to a friend of his, and this friend is like, hey, I don't want anything to do with this. He was like, Armas just came to me and asked me to help him get rid of a car that he no longer needs. It's at a Walmart parking lot. So he dropped Armas off. He gets in the car. And he says that Armas told him that he was bringing it to a junkyard, like a tow truck junkyard or whatever. And when they got there, because obviously he needed to follow him there to pick him back up, he tells the tow truck yard guy, quote, when you're done taking whatever you want off the car, I want you to crush the car. End quote. So that's what this friend tells the police. But before this happens, because they already had the friend say, like, this is the tow truck yard we went to, this is what happened, this is what he said, the police rush over to the tow truck yard, and the car is still there. The guy didn't do it yet.
Oh, my God.
So now they've tracked down the car. And the tow truck yard is like, take it. Like, I don't want anything to do with this either. Like, take it. So they take the car, they search it, and there's blood in the trunk. So they bring Armis back in for questioning. The investigators tell him that they noticed a bunch of inconsistencies in his statement. And they said that you got into an argument with her on the 19th, that you got out of the car and you hitchhiked with a truck driver and then walked 13 miles. But they say your cell phone records show that you made a call from near your home at 3:47 p.m. on the 19th, which would have estimated that he would have arrived to his house until 6:47 p.m. or mm-hmm. later than that if he had walked. And this mm-hmm. whole time during this interview, he's like, I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying, but I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. Like, I walked. I walked. Like, he's trying to convince them that he is, like, you know,
yeah.
road runner or something and could make it back to the house in less than 2 hours.
Yeah.
So, they also, this is what, like, a one part that I was just like, dude, just fucking admit it. Like, why? Like, there's so many things that are against you right now. And now you're yeah. just, like, lying to make up for the lie. And it's just, like, ridiculous. So they also get, like I said, they have Hannah's phone records. And they then learn that she received a voicemail at 5 p.m. that day.
Mm-hmm.
And this voicemail and phone call pinged right near his house.
Oh.
So the cell phone...
Yeah.
Her cell phone was with him the whole time.
Yeah.
So it's like, and it's still, he's like, oh, I didn't do it. I don't know what you're talking about. I got out of the car. You know, he's just like trying to grasp at straws.
You're trapped.
Yeah. And it's not working.
No.
So now they work backwards. They go to his mother's house. They find... Literally, he didn't even burn things. Like, he did burn some of the evidence from the car, including her jacket, but he didn't burn it all the way. There were pieces of her jacket still in a fire pit outside of his mother's house, including rubber from the car, from the mats that he tried, the bloody mats that he tried to burn. Mm-hmm. They were all still there, like, pieces of it. So
everyone's stupid.
I know. And it's just like, if you're going to do this shit, like, not that I condone murder, but like, why? Like, why? Just admit yeah. it if you're going to make stupid mistakes like this.
Right.
So then there are bones that are found by a creek off the U.S. 301 north of Orange Heights in Florida. So these bones are brought into evidence, they're examined, and the DNA is matched, from DNA that they took from, her toddler son, as well as her mother. And, they are
her biological mother.
Huh. I totally forgot.
That's interesting.
Because that's what this article said from, I think this was where I got that information from. Yeah, most of my stuff is from the Gainesville News. So I don't know why they said, well, this is what it says. I'm going to quote them since this might be a discrepancy. So it said that DNA from Brim's son and mother were used by the University of North Texas Center for Human Identification to compare it to the DNA taken from the bones. DNA evidence has confirmed that the bones found in the creek were those of Hannah Zahner Brim. So maybe they did have contact with the mother, her biological mother, and it just wasn't, you know... Sorry. Jackson! Go lay down. Maybe they did have contact with the mother, and it just wasn't something that was brought up in any of the articles, or
if they could get it, this was the only thing, and they're like, hey,
yeah, you know, yeah, yeah, that could be true. But they did have it as well from her son, which definitively confirmed that the bones in the creek were Hannah's. So
crazy that it was, this is how long after, and it's bones?
Well, I'm assuming he burned.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I think he burned her. Yeah. So on Friday afternoon, August 25th, 2016, the Gainesville Police Department announced the evidence and the findings that they had. And Nelson Ariel Armis, who was 29 at this time, was taken into custody and was arrested and indicted on September 14th, 2016, by the Aluchia County Grand Jury for first-degree murder, charges of auto theft, and tampering with evidence. And he was remanded to the Aluchia, I hope I'm saying that right, county jail. Okay, so the trial then starts. The state's attorney, Sean Brewer, he basically, his opening arguments are just like straightforward. He just tells them, you know, from the start of the case, like exactly what happened, the crime scene, the investigation, and he paints a very clear picture to the jury about what happened. He says, quote, "Hannah Brim didn't deserve to die. Hannah Brim didn't deserve to have her body burned and chopped up. Hannah Brim didn't deserve to have her body dumped near the woods off 301 and 26. Now, the defense attorney, Bill Salmon, he argues that none of the evidence the prosecution provides will prove that Armis is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The standard for the jury to reach a conviction, he said, quote, "He's innocent now. He's innocent in every witness that you hear, every piece of evidence that you see. You can't imagine. You can't wonder. You can't think. You can't even suspect. Not a single piece of it proves any criminal act beyond all reasonable doubt." And I'm like, you're a terrible lawyer. Like,
if that's your argument,
your argument here is just like, right, everything that the prosecution says, all the witnesses, they're all just lying. This is not going to prove that he did this. And I'm
don't
done.
Don't listen to them. Listen to me.
Yeah. I'm like, wow, this defense attorney is terrible. I feel like if I had to defend this guy, like, cause you know, we have to. And I always say this, like, I could never be a lawyer because I could not feel obligated to defend these people. But if he couldn't afford a lawyer, one is appointed to him. And it's usually not your choice. You have to do, as a lawyer, because I've done a bunch of research now for my script, that there's a certain amount of hours you have to spend on pro bono cases. And a lot of them are cases like this, where you're just appointed to a defendant and you have to try to build the best case to prove that they didn't do it. And if I was Bill Salmon, I would be like, okay, you probably did it. So here, let's just say they're all this evidence is a lie and, you know, and see where we make it, you know, like, yeah. I think I would do the same thing, but it is, you know, it is the name of the game. Anyway. So Susan Zahner, Hannah's mother, she testifies as well as a bunch of Hannah's friends, and they tell the jury everything that they told the police and everything that happened the day and the days leading up to finding Hannah's remains. A cellmate of Nelson Armis, he testifies as well. He says that he was in jail with Armis and that he confessed. But the defense gets up and they basically say that this witness is not credible because this witness was in jail with Nelson back in 2014 to 2015. And if that's the case, then the crime allegedly took place in 2016. So how could he have confessed?
Yeah, what?
So I'm like, I don't really understand that.
That's so sloppy.
Yeah, so I don't know. Like, this was from an article from the Gainesville News. So hopefully there was a reason for that. But the prosecutor did counter and say that the defense's claims that this witness is not credible is because the passage of about 3 years may lead to a lapse in memory concerning the exact timing, but that his and other informants who have testified provided enough information to lead to the recovery of the bloodied knife and the human bones that are connected to the case. So I don't know. I don't know if there was any... It's just kind of contradictory, but according to the trial, there's no trial transcripts. I tried to find that too. But, you know, it's just, I'm not really sure exactly how this all played out. But they did get in the show as well on the case. There were several people who were in contact with Nelson Armas and who knew him and may have helped in it, like unknowingly helped him, gave testimony that, and that's how they led to the knife and the bones and his mother's house. So I think there was just like, you know, so
yeah.
So the evidence that was actually in favor of the defense was that there was an analyst that did not discover any DNA on the bloody knife because it was abandoned outside and it was months after Hannah was killed. So the evidence had degraded, so they weren't able to definitively match the DNA from the knife to Hannah. But that was really all the evidence that I could find that actually favored the defense. But all the other evidence, the surveillance video, the rubber mats and the her jacket being burned at his mother's house, like all of that stuff outweighs that there was some degraded DNA evidence that wasn't able to be matched. And at this point, there was also a stall in the trial because during the trial, one of the jurors told Judge Pena, who I forgot to mention in the beginning, Judge Pena is the judge that presides over this case, that she realized that she has met one of the witnesses before.
Oh.
So she comes forward and says, like, I've met him, but it was at a county event that she had planned. And it was a very short, brief interaction, and she just didn't want them to, the trial to be thrown or, like, a mistrial. So she came forward and was honest and said...
Good for her!
Yeah, right? I was like, wow, okay. And she said that it will not influence her judgment on the case, but she does want them to be aware of it. So then both prosecutors and defense and the judge... you know, had like a sidebar and they all agreed that it was not a long enough encounter for her to be, you know, swayed biased. Either way. Yeah. Biased. So they allowed her to continue on the jury. And in closing arguments, the prosecutor said, quote, Almas killed what he couldn't control. Hannah Brim was murdered and the man who did it is sitting right before you. Armas lied to detectives as a way to distance himself from Hannah and the crime because he had a guilty conscience. Armas's story to the police did not add up, and when Armas stated he left Hannah's Toyota Camry following an argument and then hitched a ride with a truck driver and walked about 13 miles home, that was a lie. And then Armas's lawyer, Bill Salmon, said that Armas did not commit a criminal act in any of the lies he told and likened the case to a puzzle that is impossible to put together. He said, quote, if the parts don't fit, we must acquit. And I was like, really,
ew,
dude?
Ew.
Really? Really? Like, gross. I'm sorry. How about you just, like, not use, like, another case and, like, be a little bit original?
That's so tacky.
It's so tacky. You're right. It's so fucking tacky. I was like, wow. This just, and then, actually, now rereading that and saying that out loud, I just now believe he's a terrible lawyer. I'm not.
It just sounds like he's, like, an idiot.
Like,
okay. And he's like, oh, I heard that before.
Yeah. let's find something that can rhyme so that we can figure, you know. It's just like, are you fucking kidding me? Anyway, so, and the defense also told the jurors that the multiple police informants who testified should not be considered reliable sources. He said, quote, the snitches they put in front of you are not worthy. They provide the least credible testimonies because they are people who will say anything to help themselves. Mm. Womp womp. I don't think so. I don't know what they're getting out of this. So, like,
well, like, I mean, we've talked about the jailhouse informants before, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, if you get a shorter sentence, whatever, if you say whatever people want to say. However, yeah, it doesn't mean that is for everybody.
No, definitely not. So the verdict comes in. The jury spends, guess how many hours?
Three.
Six. You were close, but six. So
I'm not feeling forgiving today.
Well, let's say that they spent 3 hours actually deliberating and three hours deciding where to go for brunch. So they find him guilty, and the judge says to Armis, quote, the jury's finding of your guilt and the facts and the evidence presented in this case demonstrate clearly to this court that you had disregard for human life, and if that weren't enough, disregard to the sanctity of Hannah Brim's remains. I would be remiss if I didn't say the following. There is no mistake in my mind that Hannah Brim was pregnant at the time you committed this murder, and you knew it, and you didn't care. End quote.
Did he get charged with
double? I don't think Florida considers a fetus a human.
Isn't that interesting for all these pro-life people? Why aren't you on that train?
Yeah. It's sad.
That's really sad.
They report that Armis stayed very calm when the verdict was read, as did his mother, Maria Hernandez. I don't know why they say her last name, but not his. Armis, he was sentenced by the judge.
His last name is Armis.
Not his. Armis. I meant other people. Well, I guess her husband. They didn't say anything about Rebecca's last name. I wonder if it's just like the witnesses maybe are being protected in some way. I don't know.
Oh, maybe.
So he was also sentenced. Judge Philip Pena was also the sentencing judge, and he sentenced him to life in prison for first degree murder, 5 years for the theft of Hannah's car, and 5 years for tampering with evidence, which included burning of her body. All would be served consecutively with time served. Hannah's family wept when they heard the verdict. Hannah's mother said, quote, Hannah was a big part of our lives, a big personality. We miss her terribly, and we are thankful for everyone who was involved and who did not give up in helping us find her remains. And we are thankful of the people of Alucha County for serving justice. The assistant state attorney, Sean Brewer, said he is, quote, relieved that the Zahner family can finally have some closure for the brutal murder of Hannah by Nelson Armis. At the end of the On the Case episode, it was Paula's interviewing her father, Art, and he's basically just recounting how he was feeling in the courtroom. And he mm-hmm. says that it was so hard for him, obviously, because the man that he knew, and this was before they read the verdict or before everything happened, that this he knew that the man that took his baby girl away was like feet away from him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he starts to like explain that, you know, he was having these thoughts that the pain that he has inflicted on their family, that it would be very easy for him to inflict that pain on him because he was so close. But he said that his wife made him promise he wouldn't. And he was like, and I did what my wife asked me to do. It's so sad, so sad. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, this, like I said, was a very straightforward case, and there wasn't really, you know, like we have a definitive answer on why mm-hmm. these, what happened to Hannah and why they happened to Hannah. But regardless of the choices that she made in her life and the people she decided to share those choices with, does not give anybody the right to take her life or the life mm-hmm. of her child away. And mm-hmm. to take that into your own hands because you're ashamed of your life and your choices mm-hmm. is just so pathetic and sad. And I just pray for her husband and her son, who now has to grow up without a mother because of the hands of somebody's stupidity. This week's episode was written and edited by me, Asia Hamilton, with music by Holly Amber Church and social media by Kelsey Gruenberg.
For pictures and sources, please follow us on Instagram at onthearbehalf_pod and on Twitter at onthearbehalf_.
Please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
On their behalf, thank you for listening.